E-12 Budget Division will come to order. We do have a quorum. Good morning, Senator Rummel.
Good morning, Senator Bonnoff. Good morning, members. It seems like we just saw each other a few minutes ago last night, so it's been a long time. And whoever has this PowerPoint set up, I just moved their thing, so I hope they won't mind. I'm here this morning bringing you Senate File 3092. This is a bill that we passed last year and somehow did not make it through the conference committee. And so we are bringing it back again for your consideration. So I thank you for your attention. We heard a lot yesterday about our young children and their readiness for school and their readiness for learning. And so it struck me that this bill probably should have been heard yesterday, except we had a lot of other things on our plate yesterday. We are living in a very different world. When I was growing up as a child, we ran around a lot, and we had, at least in the neighborhood I lived in, we had this whole area in the back where we could go down to a pond, we could climb a cliff, we could climb trees. The world today for children is very different, and as a result, our children are growing up differently. And we are seeing increases in such things as ADHD and ADD and phonemic awareness. There's somebody here that's interested in phonemic awareness. All of these kinds of things that were developed normally because of a more free environment have had an impact on the way our children are growing up today. So I have with me today Mr. Bob DeBoer. We have a bill that provides grant money for people to attend. It's a voluntary program, and it's called, let me see, I had it written down here, Chance to Grow. It's a learning resource center. And it's pretty exciting. When I was in college, and that's a long time ago, folks, my professor of educational psychology was teaching us the kinds of things that Mr. DeBoer is going to describe to you today. Here we were 18-year-olds doing the very things he's going to describe to you today. And I think he can tell the story much better than I can. So I'm going to turn the mic over to Mr. DeBoer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Bob DeBoer. I'm co-founder of New Visions Charter School. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak today, Madam Chair and Senators. Unfortunately, two other partners couldn't come today. Joy Page, who was a principal in Richfield, which is one of our new smart sites, had to go to a special ed meeting. And Nancy Farnham, who is the director of the Minnesota Learning Resource Center, is presenting at the Early Childhood Conference up in Bemidji today. So you'll have to bear with me. As many of you know, charter schools, one of the reasons why people started charter schools was to develop innovative interventions to help public education, help kids in public education. And at New Visions, we took that to heart. And the Minnesota Learning Resource Center grew out of that experience. We had developed a number of interventions that we found to be very effective with our student body. So we went to the legislature in 1998 and proposed replicating some of those interventions through the Minnesota Learning Resource Center. And so if you look at your packets and look at this map of the state, you'll see the schools that we've worked with since 1998. And there are three different kinds of apples, and they represent the three programs. The blue apple represents the core program, the Smart Boost Up program. And Smart Boost Up is a program where we teach the classroom teachers and personnel at a school to go through a series of movement activities to stimulate their brains to address some developmental issues, which I'll talk about in greater detail. So most of the schools start with doing the Smart Boost Up program. Some schools use our EEG neurotechnology program, which is the red apple. And the EEG neurotechnology is the use of computer technology to have children drive video games with their mind and therefore improve their attention skills and reduce hyperactivity. So we've worked with about 50 schools across the nation, actually, who have replicated the neurotechnology. And again, it helps with reducing hyperactivity. It helps with improving attention. It helps with anxiety. And then we have a third program, the auditory stimulation program, which is the Green Apple. And again, this is a program that we've found to be very effective for those children who have auditory processing problems. There'll be children who are distracted by the fan and the vent. Very often, children who are diagnosed as EBD, emotional behavior disorder, have an auditory processing problem that they can't process what the teacher is saying or what's going on in the classroom. And this intervention can be done 15 minutes a day in the classroom and improve phonics, improve comprehension. And again, no longer kids have to be sent down to the principal's office for behavior issues.
Mr. DeBoer, excuse me, what is the intervention? What do you do?
The Smart Boost Up program is, if you look at the some of the newspaper articles that are here from the different communities, you'll see it's a series of activities where the children roll, spin, crawl, creep, monkey bars. They do a lot of classroom adaptations for instructional strategies. So children are really getting the stimulus through their visual pathway, auditory pathway, and their tactile kinesthetic sense. And the children do 30 minutes a day of that activity. And each school may deliver it in a different way. It could be done in a gymnasium. It could be done in a dedicated classroom. It could be done in the hallway. It can be done by just pushing the desks away. Each school has different space needs and capabilities. And so children just go through this series of activities. We've developed a curriculum over the last 20 years. So the schools send a team of teachers to our training workshops, and we teach them how the brain develops, how you can speed up brain development, how that's connected to learning, and then how to do these curriculum activities. And then our professionals go out to the school on a monthly basis to mentor them in the implementation of those activities. So it's about a half hour a day integrated throughout the day.
Senator Rummel.
When I said in the beginning, our environment for children has changed, and because I had the class I had in college, my kids were never put in a playpen. Today, we confine children, we carry them, we put them in car seat things, and we carry them around. They don't get the creeping and the crawling and the moving things that develop the brain stem. So that's why these movement things are so important. If I had my druthers, we would all get together and really get some brain development science. So all these things, whether it's the physical education that we talked about yesterday or the phonics we talked about a few weeks ago, all of these things are connected, and some of them as early as very, very, you know, when kids are moving from laying on their backs in a crib to when they're crawling around the house. The critical years that our kids are currently deprived.
Thank you. And Senator Saltzman had a question.
Yes. You know, Mr. Burke, if you could tell me how long does it take to train your teachers? What is the workshop like? What sort of involvement is it, and the amount of time and those kind of things,
sure.
Please.
Thank you, Senator Saltzman. What we do, the schools send the team, and of at least four, and it's classroom teachers and FIED teacher. And again, it's a four-day training where we train them in the neurophysiology of brain development and the connection to learning. And then we explain all of the activities and experience them, demonstrate them. And so by the time they leave, they understand why some of those behaviors they used to get frustrated with were happening in the class and why they happened. And over, our evaluations are extremely positive. Our teachers say, I've been teaching for 25 years, and all of a sudden now I get it. I understand why these kids are not learning. And it really, our goal is to change the whole culture of the school so they look at kids differently and they have some different tools and options. So there's that four-day training input. And then there's the monthly visits where the mentors from Minnesota Learning Resource Center come to the school site and help them implement the curriculum, help them answer questions. They may meet with parent groups. They may meet with other teachers on the staff. Mm-hmm. And over the years, principals have sent more and more of their staff, and the goal is to have a change in the culture, a shift, to look at kids developmentally, especially for those in that bottom half of the classroom.
Senator Saltzman.
Yes. Excuse me. I'm a Madam Chair and a Mr. DeBoer. This reminds me of some of the other things that, you know, we're working on in this committee, and I've been working on with Senator Olson, and that's looking at, we have these practices that we find very effective, and then we kind of wonder what's higher ed doing, perhaps, to incorporate this into their, you know, curriculum.
Right.
And is this a copyrighted program, or is this something that is this, you know, your specific program, or is it something that perhaps higher ed could be looking at? And maybe not this exact program, but, you know, I'm hearing a four-day workshop. I mean, we keep hearing we sent our teachers to a four-day workshop and they came back and it really changed the way that they taught or the way they managed their classroom. And I just keep scratching my head thinking, geez, if these are really effective, why aren't we exposing some of our young teachers to this as part of their, you know, pre-service? And obviously, and I'm not saying that staff development later on is not important. That absolutely has to happen. But it just seems critical. And Senator Rumble, you mentioned you had a class to kind of, it's a very interesting perspective.
Thank you, Senator Saltzman. It's a good question. We could spend probably the whole morning answering that question. But my approach to all of this is to make it available to people. First of all, to figure out how to deliver it so people of limited means, economic means, or middle class means can access these interventions. But once I've been able to figure that out, I don't need to copyright it. I'll share it with anyone. So what we've done is we're constantly reviewing the brain research and adding new things as things are learned. So it isn't really a copywritten, I mean, it is in the sense of the curriculum guide, but it's nothing that we really are trying to hoard and not share with people. As to the higher ed institution, that's a real good question in relation to this program and probably in relation to almost all of the innovation being done in education, because it kind of percolates from below. And, you know, higher ed needs to have an incentive to want to really look at it. You know, and when we talk about through under No Child Left Behind, holding schools, teachers accountable, it hasn't quite percolated all the way up to higher ed institutions. So we have several colleges that do give credit, and all the teachers give college credit for the training they get. But that really is something that I'm hoping will be something of the future, because this is something that could be easily incorporated into all of the teachers coming up. Just like now there is more appreciation of the need to teach the science of teaching reading, where there wasn't there before. I mean, because elementary teachers would maybe have a couple days worth of exposure to how to teach reading, and now it's much more developed. So hopefully that will come.
Did you want to address the audiology program?
Senator Saltzman.
Yes, it is a FOP, and thank you very much. I think that you've confirmed my thought of how do we as a legislature help engage higher ed? Because as you mentioned, things are coming from the bottom up, and yet they are, you know, producing teachers. And how can we, either with a carrot or a stick, we'd like to do a carrot, but when there isn't that response, that sometimes you have to find ways to encourage them to come to the table. And if they don't want to come, then we have that ability to, if we think something's important. And I think we've done that with some strategies to put them into statute of what they should be incorporating into their teacher programs.
Right.
I'm very interested in this.
Senator Rummel, did you have a comment?
Oh, I was just going to, I believe that Mr. DeBoer did not get to explain the audiology program.
Well, the auditory stimulation program is we give a child an audiogram, and we determine what frequencies they're perceiving auditorily. If that child cannot hear the frequency associated with the sound of the letter P, no amount of phonics, no amount of drilling will ever make that kid successful. And then we also determine whether left or right eared. Normal human development is your right ear, and that goes to the language center in the left hemisphere. Have you ever known anyone who's had a stroke in the left hemisphere? They can't talk because that's where the language center is. And so what we found from the experts that we sent our staff to in Denmark is that children with learning disabilities, and especially children and adults with dyslexia, oftentimes are left-eared. And so sometimes they'll reverse their spoken language. So for the word spaghetti, they might say paschetti. And the reason they say paschetti is because the frequency wave of of the sound of the letter P moves more rapidly than S, and it gets to the language center always first. So we determine all that, and then the child listens to a tape for 15 minutes a day. And after 50 hours of listening, we're able to change that audiogram, that the performance in the auditory pathway. And again, what we see in the classroom then is phonics go up, comprehension goes up. Children who used to not get jokes all of a sudden now are getting the subtleties of jokes. And we find that many of the kids that were EBD, behavior problems, are no longer being sent to the principal's office because they can absorb what's going on around them auditorily or whatever the teacher is asking them to perform on. So it's a very efficient intervention. That one and the neurotechnology tends to be the ones schools turn to after they start the Smart Boost Up program. And so that's why all of our discussions have been focused on that movement program. That's kind of the core.
Mr. DeBoer, can you tell us how integrated is this curriculum into the classroom? How many hours does your program actually go on in a classroom? And are we talking K through 6? What is the scope of the impact that you're doing?
It's a good question. Thank you, Chairman. There's three kind of contexts we train the schools how to integrate this. One of them is a movement component, which can be, again, done in a dedicated classroom or in the Phi-Ed gymnasium. The second one is how you teach some of the activities in the classroom, as far as word families, improving auditory skills. And the third is your recess time. When the children go out who are in a smart school where we're working, when they go out for recess, they first have to go through 3 or 4 routines before they free play. So we try to grab minutes throughout the day to a total of about 30 minutes. And the model is that typically schools start with K or K1. We say that K through 2, doing 30 minutes a day, integrating this throughout the day, you're not going to be wasting any time. And we had one school that was a K2 building. So it was all, like, they had 9 units of first grade, 9 units of second grade. And the second graders who were reading as third graders in the fall after doing the Smart Boost Up were reading as fifth graders in the spring. Or in one of the articles that I gave you is from Jordan. And the principal from Jordan testified last year how in the fall only 52% of the third graders in Jordan Elementary in Jordan, Minnesota were reading at grade level. And after 4 months of doing the Smart Boost Up program, 90% of them were reading at grade level in third grade. So so the goal is to be K-3, but if you have, after that, if you have children, so it's done systemically with all of the kids. If you have kids after third grade who are struggling with reading, then you might pull them out and give them individual intervention. But and so we go out the first year every month, the second year every other month, and then the final year where we kind of culminate our work with the school, where there may be 4 times a year. And then our goal is then the school will be on its own. Because if you look at the handout we gave you, you know, since 1998 when the legislature first funded this training center, we've worked with about 111 traditional schools throughout Minnesota, typically K-6 schools. And so we're always kind of winding up some schools and starting new schools. And the thing that was so ironic for us and frustrating, tragic, whatever verb you want to use, for us was that when we lost our funding because of this, the cuts and everything this last session, was when we had the greatest interest in our program. So typically we have about 30 schools in Minnesota. Now we have 42 schools we're working with this year because of the demand.
Senator Rummel, could you tell us the appropriation request that you've put before us? How many schools or school districts would that bring this program to?
I may have to turn that over to Mr. DeBoer.
Thank you. Our overall budget is about $250,000 to work with the 42 schools. And part of that, each school district has a local investment. The appropriation from the legislature is paid for half of the workshop fees, so the schools are paying the other half, and it pays for all of the mentoring costs of going out on a monthly basis. And so the local districts are investing in the workshop fees, They're dedicating space. They're freeing up their teachers to meet with our mentors. So there is a local investment with the legislature. But we used to, if you look at the second page of the fact sheet, you can see that we used to be funded at $250,000 a year. Then it was cut to $160,000 a year. And so that's what we're asking for this coming year, in order to allow us to continue to do the work. And it's interesting, I'd forgotten this note, because I know that the legislature is under tremendous pressure of how do you meet all the needs. Even when we had a $4.5 billion deficit, we still continued to receive funding. So we just said, given the need, given the data, given the interest, we just feel we need to come back so we could continue working for next year.
Mr. Nauman, could you tell the committee how we've appropriated this in the past and what you might recommend?
excuse me, Madam Chair. Mr. DeBoer is in fact correct in terms of the appropriation levels, but members of this committee may remember, I apologize, I got a frog in my throat, the Best Practices Program. We have, it was a program that I think was first created in the 98 or 99 session, and then it was initiated out of this committee to model good educational practices, and it was a pot of money that the department allocated to, for lack of a better word, do good things. And in part, what we have done in years past, and New Visions is one of the examples of this, is created a set-aside underneath that. So if you pull out the bill and look for an appropriation for New Visions, you won't find it, at least in the last three education finance bills. You will find a rider. And what Mr. DeBoer has spoken to is that initially that rider was $250,000. And then as we did involve some of the budget cuts in 2003, that rider was scaled back because the whole program was scaled back. And it dropped to $160,000.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Bergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, when Mr. DeBoer came to my office the first time, I will readily confess I thought, oh, this is warm and fuzzy. and we had a longer conversation, and I really appreciated what I came around to learn from Mr. DeBoer and about the type of things that he's talking about. And maybe I've said it before in this committee, and I hate to subject you to it again, but at the same time, it's really important. And maybe when I stepped out, it was talked about a little bit. There are such different learning styles within our children and within our families, the whole thing. You have the child that learns visually, see the picture, look at the book, you know, that type of thing. The person that walks in a restaurant, and if the menu has great pictures, they know what they want to order without looking at the text. That's the visual learner. Then you have the audio learner, the one that the teacher talking to them, they hear what the teacher says, they take in what the teacher says, and they really learn from it. And when they walk in a restaurant, they actually hear what the waitress said the specials are. They don't have to go back and listen again. Mm-hmm. But then you have the other smaller group of people and children. They're called the kinesthetic learners. And the kinesthetic learners require something entirely different. And I really learned that through time. They require kind of a hands-on, kind of a almost a physical stimulus, if you will, and they learn through touch, through feel, through living, breathing example. And when I see these pictures of, you know, someone crawling along a pathway and learning, because there's something on that pathway to learn, or the children here walking on the half circles with their bare feet and stuff like that, that's how some kids learn, through taking it in physically. And that's kind of a lost group, if you will. And I know this is good for all kids, but I kind of see it as these are the kids, too, by the way, that are often called ADHD, ADD, all of those kind of things. They're labeled, and maybe those labels are correct, but I think more often a kinesthetic learning child is far more quick to be labeled because they're not doing as well in a classroom. And it simply is because they aren't taught in a style that pulls the information into them and that they learn from. And that's what I see this doing. And maybe not just this program in particular, but that's what I see as a whole group of kids that are missing the opportunity to learn because no one's taking the time to figure out how to teach them. And so that's why I'm hoping through what Senator Salzman and Senator Olson are doing and things like this, we can reach out to those kids that have those strong capabilities but aren't really giving the opportunity right now in the standard 36 in a classroom, sit down, be quiet, and look at the book.
Senator Wergen, I couldn't agree with you more because I have one of those. And I went through elementary school, and teacher after teacher would tell me that he should be diagnosed. And that wasn't my son. He was just a wild kid. And he learned through rolling around the ground. And he ended up, you know, playing baseball, football, basketball, because he had to be moving at every minute. And he's an outstanding student today. And I never accepted those diagnoses. So I'm with you.
Madam Chair? I'm speaking of my son. He's 22 now. He went through 13 years of absolutely hating every day of school.
Yes.
Graduated from high school. I never dreamt he would ever go back to any kind of school again. He hit 22 and he's back in school, but now he's taking hands-on things and it's working. It's just, and he too, the answer from the teachers was give him a pill.
Thank you, Senator Wergen. Mr. DeBoer.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senators, one thing that I think would help frame what we do and how it's different, addresses some of what Senator Wergen was saying, and that is if you look at the brain research that's come out since the 90s, one of the things we can do is we can divide the brain in kind of two general areas. There's the cortex and there's the brain stem, which Senator Rummel was talking about. And the cortex is the part of our brain that controls our conscious thought. And the brainstem controls all of the coordination of all of our unconscious motor activity. And so when I'm talking to you, my cortex is thinking about what I'm trying to say to you, but my brainstem is controlling my lips, my tongue, my breathing, my sitting up, all that unconscious activity. And so another example might be, if you think back when you first learned to drive a car, and maybe your parent was there, and they're going to teach you how to drive a car. You know, where did you have your hands? You know, 10 and 2. And you're hanging onto that steering wheel, and you're really focused and concentrating. When you came here today, you're driving your car, the radio is on, you may be talking on a cell phone, and if you smoke, you may have been smoking all at the same time. You weren't even thinking about how you were driving that car because it had become an automatic brainstem function. And what we know about child development is that the brain, when the brainstem is becoming myelinated and activated in the early childhood years, readiness skills come into play. Readiness skills that teachers assume are in place, like the ability for your eyes to move across a page smoothly, in unison. But if you don't have that readiness skill, you'll skip words and letters. So how many of you worked with children who, when they read, they skip letters and words? Why do they do that? Because they're stupid? No. It's because they don't have that learning readiness skill in place. And so what we believe is that all the boost-up smart activities are aimed at stimulating the brainstem to work, and by doing enough of that activity, you're going to develop richer, more automatic skills of those readiness nature that are the foundation for learning. And so that's why it's real important to see that difference between the cortex and the brainstem and how this is real developmental and aiming at getting those brainstem foundational skills in place. Then SMART fits into the continuum that you're faced with. You know, there's reading first, there's phonics, there's whole language, there's RTI. And once the children have the learning readiness foundation skills in place, they can benefit from those interventions. And so this is why it's so effective with that K through 2 age group, because those kids are still struggling to learn to read. And if they don't have the foundation learning readiness skills, you'll be constantly working around that deficit.
Thank you. Senator Rummel.
Madam Chair, I think Mr. DeBoer is also working with some pre-K situations, and it seems to me that it would be, you know, to our advantage to educate not just our parents through ECFE, but our ECFE and child care, all of those us who are interested in quality child care, because at least the SMART part, the exercising, the bodily movement part would be very, very helpful in getting those children ready for K. So did you want to speak a little bit about that pre-kindergarten work you're doing?
Certainly. No, I don't want to. I'm sorry. I was caught off guard. Thank you very much, Senator Rumble and Chair, Madam Chair and Senators. People, because of what we understand about early childhood, people have long, for a long time said, wouldn't this work better with early childhood? And partially because the brain is so plastic in the first 5 years. 95% of your neurological development happens in the first 5 years of life. Well, but we started with K-6, K-3, because we had simple measures of our impact, because the schools were gathering all the reading scores. But we kept being approached by Head Start centers. So we've taken on for the last 3 years a 5-year project with the foundation community in Minnesota, Bush and McKnight and Minneapolis Foundation, to work with 22 Head Start centers in Mojave and Anoka, Washington. And we had to step back and modify the whole training, the curriculum guide, and everything. And so we're just starting to get some of that data, and we're seeing the same thing. The challenge you have with early childhood, which you all probably know, is how do you measure what's working? Because you don't have a reading score, and so the evaluation is very expensive because you got to get at something that's really observable or understandable for evaluating the effectiveness. But our first year of data last year was very promising, and certainly if anyone's interested in that report, I could send that to them. But basically what we're trying to do is develop all of this before we would come to a legislative leader or a foundation and say, we know this works. We want to have a few more years of experience.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments?
Madam Chair, if there are none, I'd like to move Senate File 3092 to be considered for inclusion in the Education Finance Omnibus Bill.
All in favor of Senator Rummel's motion, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is passed. Thank you, Senator Rummel. Thank you, Mr. DeBoer.
And thank you, members.
So next, we're going to be going through the governor's bill, and Senator Stumpf, who is carrying this bill, is still presenting another bill, so we'll just go ahead and let the governor's staff begin that presentation.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Nauman.
To adjust, as I mentioned yesterday, there was an amendment to the governor's package, and I think that's being handed out now just to conform the governor's recommendation to what they intended to introduce. So I think that's the A2 amendment.
So Senator Scheid moves the Senate File 3631 be amended with the A2. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is passed. We'll give the department just a little time to set up and get their things together.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, unfortunately there is no zip drive for the PowerPoint, but we do have a copy of it, so I'll just go through page by page, if you don't mind. We'll have to be a little low-tech today.
Please say your name for the record.
Yes, Chaz Anderson, Deputy Education Commissioner.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. The handout I guess we'll start with looks like this. It's photocopied, has two slides per page on it. This is the governor's 2008 supplemental K-12 budget. Going to the second slide, one of the focuses you'll see in this budget is a focus on teacher quality. And why is that? We know from a lot of research out there that effective teachers increase student achievement and will work to close the achievement gap. A few of the studies that we found includes Dr. Robert Marzano, who found that effective teachers had the most highest positive impact on moving student achievement, found that it had a 43% positive impact. It was only second to parents. The second study we've noted is from Tennessee. This is from Bill Sanders. If two average 8-year-old students are given this different teachers, one a low-performing teacher, one a high-performing teacher, the students' performance diverge more than 50 percentile points within 3 years. So you can see the impact of having effective versus ineffective teachers. In Dallas, a similar result. The performance gap between students assigned to 3 effective teachers in a row and those assigned to 3 ineffective teachers in a row was 49 percentage points from a McKinsey report. again, in Minnesota, and like across the nation, we're going to face a pretty significant teacher shortage, and that's actually a workforce shortage is going to happen all over in the private sector and public sector. But if you look at our Minnesota teaching workforce right now, about almost one half of the teaching profession will retire in the next 10 to 15 years. So we're going to have to find a high supply of effective teachers to fill that gap. Going to the fourth slide, the three strategies we're employing overall, and you'll see within this budget, is one, we need to retrain our existing teaching workforce in certain particular areas, including math and science. Two is recruit the best and the brightest into the teaching profession, and we'll talk about some of those strategies. And three is to retain effective teachers in the system and so they do not leave. Going to the sixth slide, the first budget proposal I'll talk about is the math and science teacher training academies. And we're really excited that the legislature did partially fund the governor's recommendation last year. Right now, actually, we're employing tier two strategy, which is a train the trainers model. It's a regionally based model in partnership with higher education to retrain our not just math and science teachers, but all of our teachers. We're focusing first on math before science because we have new math standards that are being implemented, and we have new math requirements for Algebra 1 in 8th grade and Algebra 2 for graduation. We're particularly focusing on those middle years because we know from our new math standards, the more rigorous standards really come in play about 4th grade, 5th grade, and that's to get them ready for Algebra 1. So we're really focusing on those middle school teachers first. But that is going well, and we're implementing that currently. So we're requesting additional dollars so that we can have a more robust model, regionally based model. Tier one strategy up above that is an addition, and that is actually looking at our current math and science teachers and providing content training for about 500 slots or 500 teachers each year through an annual summer institute. This is similar to what we do with our IB and AP teachers. It's very effective. They come in, they get training through in the summer for that's based on content and looking at content and learning content and taking that content into instructional practices in the classroom. The total request here for the two tiers is $2.7 million in fiscal year 09. Going to the next slide, this is part of our strategy to recruit the best and brightest in the teaching profession. Is the Minnesota Teach Program, and that is an alternative pathway to certification. This is also trying to anticipate, as we look at the teacher shortages, how are we going to employ strategies to get our best and brightest into the classrooms? And this proposes an alternative pathway for mid-career professionals that want to change professions and for professionals starting out their career and perhaps they want to decide that they want to go into teaching. The program is limited actually to shortage areas. It's not for all licenses. Currently, those shortage areas include math, science, special education, world languages, and ELL. Districts agree to participate in the program. They're active participants in the selection. They must also have a shortage area in those subject areas. And they are the ones that are an employer and make the employment offer. As part of the condition, the participants receive rigorous training before they enter the classroom. They receive on-the-job mentoring, ongoing evaluations throughout the first year before a permanent license is issued. Candidates are also eligible to receive 15 graduate credits. If you go to the next page, it really talks about what the legislation requires as a minimum before getting in the program. And I'd like to refer to a study that was quite a thorough study done by McKinsey late last year. It looks like this. It's in your packets. And basically what they did is they looked at highly effective systems across the world and in the United States and said, what sort of strategies are they employing to hire effective teachers? And one of the things that they mentioned is that it's very tough in a lot of high-performing countries and high-performing systems in the United States to become a teacher. It's not an easy entrance. And so this is modeled after the new Teaching Fellows program in New York City, which has been highly effective. And that the entrance into this program is not easy. You have minimum requirements, but you also have to go through an interview process to even be part of the training program, and that doesn't guarantee you're going to get into the classroom. But the minimum requirements include having a bachelor's degree from a 4-year accredited post-secondary institution, having a minimum GPA of 3.0, passing the Minnesota Teacher Competency Test, showing employment experience or experience related to the subject to be taught, There's an interview process that the school districts participate in as they are participating in the program. There's a final selection that gets you into the pool to go into the training, and then it's restricted to certain areas, as I've discussed. So just meeting the minimum requirements doesn't necessarily get you first into the pool to be trained, and then getting into the pool to be trained, the district decides to make the employment offer. So it's sort of modeling after, let's provide an alternative pathway for some of our best and brightest folks, and then but making it tough to go through and have to go through a rigorous training program before you enter the classroom. On the next slide is a little bit what I've talked about is the Teaching Fellows Program in New York City. New York City created this program in 2000. They had a significant problem with unlicensed teachers being hired, uncertified teachers. In 2003, the Board of Regents decided they would no longer allow that. And so that this was the reason why they were able to do that, because they had developed this Teaching Fellows Program, and they actually brought in the Teach for America program as well. But if you look at the average score on the New York Teacher Certification Exam, you'll see that the Teaching Fellow participants and actually also the Teach for America participants score higher than the normal traditional route and those that are not licensed.
Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner, could you please address the Teach for America program? You haven't mentioned that. Is that something that the department is including in your recommendations? Or I see that they actually, those students got the highest score.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Teach for America program, it's actually a program for young professionals just as they've left college. It's not for mid-career changers. So these are 22, 23-year-olds that have a bachelor's degree in a content area, math, science, English, and they decide they want to go work in some of the highest need schools across the country. So it's not they're not going to go work in a suburban school. They're going to the New York Cities, the Minneapolises, the Cincinnatis, et cetera. And what they go through is they go through a training program, and then they are placed in districts that participate in the Teach for America program. Currently, Teach for America is actually trying to come into Minnesota. They do have a higher education partner in Hamline University. Right now they are working with signing up districts and charter schools. The program is a very successful program in New York. They employ both strategies of the Teaching Fellows and the Teach for America, and we feel the same way. We think Teach for America is a strong program. We've assisted with it coming to Minnesota. They just have a different model because it doesn't involve mid-career professionals. I think that's a very key point that we want to look at. Folks that maybe had a career for 15, 20 years at 3M, being an engineer, and now they want to go and become they want to be a science high school science teacher. And Teach for America doesn't provide that route. So we're trying to provide here another option that could be in Minnesota and modeled after the Teaching Fellows program.
Senator Saltzman.
Right. You know, I know quite a bit about Teach for America because my son went through the application process and was accepted. And it's an extremely intensive interview process that they are really trying to find kids who are going to be highly motivated and won't give up. Repeatedly throughout his interviews, he was asked how he has ever overcome obstacles and pounded that in. And they also offer incredible support once, you know, the students and, like, you know, the new teachers are placed. There's a video on it and how they gather on weekends and they have support groups and they have people, and a lot of corporate funding is doing this as well as funding that part of the program. So it's very interesting, very intriguing, and I think it brings young people into the field who chose a different path in college and wanted a broader education. And I know that some feel that it brings people in for a couple years and they leave, but the thing about Teach for America, too, is that those young people who have taught have that experience the rest of their life, no matter where they go, into what other profession, if they're in law or medicine or anything else, they know those kids. So it's a very interesting program.
Senator Saltzman, I too have that experience with Teach for America, and so I am hopeful that as you talk about this program that you are looking at that as well as the mid-career, because I think as we look at our teachers, as we look at our workforce shortage, our greatest challenge is to attract those students right as they come out of college and try and provide an environment where our best and brightest do want to stay in Minnesota and want to be in our schools. Senator Rummel? And then Senator Coker.
Well, this may sound like echoing and echoing. My son's best friend, who was valedictorian of our high school when he graduated, became Teach for America, and he did become, he was assigned in California, and he's now a full-time teacher in California. And I'm curious, do you have any data on how many Teach for America actually do move into teaching as a career?
Commissioner. Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, I do not have the data on hand. I know that a lot of the Teach for America, they make a commitment to teach a certain number of years. And there is a significant dropout that they teach for those years, and then they move on. But I will say that, you know, they're going into the toughest schools across the country, and it's a very difficult job. But what I will say, though, is what they find is that they may not necessarily stay at that school in the classroom, but they go back home and teach, or they become administrators, or they work in education policy. In fact, the current D.C. superintendent that was just hired about a year ago was a Teach for America alum, so they become superintendents. And so they stay in the realm of education is what they find. They just don't necessarily stay in that classroom that they were hired to teach originally in.
Senator Koch.
Oh, well, Madam Chair, I really was just going to say that I don't see them as exclusive at all. I think they're very symbiotic, where Minnesota Teach and Teach for America. I mean, I think it works together. So,
good. Thank
no,
you.
No problem with both of them.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, going to the next slide, just a couple of sort of studies that have been out there about alternative pathways. The Brookings Institute did the Hamilton Project. They recommended removing barriers to teachers that will encourage new college graduates and mid-career professionals to enter the profession. They actually looked at, this is very interesting, talking about teacher effectiveness. They looked at LA Unified School District's human resources practices and found out just initially if they had screened out what looked like bad applicants from the process and not allowed them into some of them into the classroom, just by having that human resources practices in place, that they would have raised student test scores 14 percentile points by graduation. So just having a strong human resources selection process in a district can make a huge difference in getting effective teachers in the classroom.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Rummel.
Assistant Deputy Commissioner, I never can get that whole thing out. What are those barriers? Can you tell us?
Commissioner. Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, you know, a lot of times the hiring practice is just having consistency on standards on what you look for in minimum application when you receive an application. And that varies from position to position because, for instance, school districts will tell you they receive hundreds of applications for an elementary education position, but not a lot for some of the shortage areas. It also is it's having a practice where you have a very set point in time when you hire teachers, so it's not something that changes from year to year, and so applicants don't really know when to apply or when that practice is. It's also having a strong screening process when you're reviewing the applicants and also when you're interviewing and having a strong process for selection and making sure one of the key points is having the model teaching, whether that be through video, whether that be through actual practice.
I think you misunderstood my
sure.
question. You said the slide says authors recommend that removing barriers to teaching.
Madam Chair, I think what Senator Rummel they meant by barriers is barriers to getting a license. And so what they're talking about is alternative pathway, what we just talked about, having a way for mid-career professionals to have an expedited way to get into the classroom rather than go back and go to school for 2 or 3 years because, as you know, many have to work and have families to support. And so it's sort of what we've talked about with Teach for America or Minnesota Teach is having a rigorous process, but having a way that those folks can get into the classroom and be effective teachers.
We get it now.
All right. We do want to get through all these and go through the details of the language of the bill as well.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just mentioned the McKinsey report, so I'll skip over that slide, but you know the report and you can read it. The next budget proposal on the next slide is the UTeach program, and actually we have handed out an article from Education Week. It's quite large in scale. But this program is a partnership with higher education. The program would recruit current students in the university and math and science departments. to offer them free courses, up to 6 free courses in the College of Education. It's sort of recruiting our current students in the system, our current undergraduate students that have declared a major, to offer them free courses at the College of Ed and to try to get seek interest in moving some of those math and science majors to the teaching profession. The next slide talks about the history of UTeach at the University of Texas, Austin. You'll see that about one telling statistics is about 3/4 of UTeach graduates remain after 5 years. That's higher than the national average of 50%. So they have a pretty good retention rate once they get them in the classroom. The next slide is retain effective teachers. I won't go into this for very long here. Everyone knows about the QCOM program. That's part of our long-term strategy to retain effective teachers. You can see the components there. On to the next slide. This is the focus on school leadership. Effective teachers are important, but we also need to have strong leaders in our building. This recommendation is to fund the Principal's Leadership Academy or Institute. This would provide $400,000 so we can continue training cohorts of principals. The next slide is the Minnesota Virtual Education Program. This is a request for $1 million in fiscal year 09 and beyond for the development of a state online teaching tool and student courses that will be developed by teachers in public schools and maintained at the Department of Education. This online program will be able to be accessed by districts and teachers at will. As the district just has to sign up if they want to participate. Their teachers also participate in the development of the online courses, and then they are free to use those courses as they wish in their schools and classrooms. And that is, again, the request is $1 million for fiscal year 2009.
Madam Chair, members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. The next slide deals with other budget changes. The first of these would be to continue the declining pupil and transportation aid for the Rushford-Peterson School District for 2 more years. The district lost about 16 and a half full-time equivalent pupils as a result of the flood damage this past summer, and past precedent has been to continue that over more than 1 year. This would cost $118,000 per year for the pupil loss protection and $40,000 per year for some of the transportation.
Dr. Melcher, does the governor recommend phasing that down over time?
Madam Chair and members, no. The governor's recommending continuing the funding at the $158,000 per year for 29 and 2010, so 2 more years at the current level.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, there have been a variety of precedents there. In some cases, the legislature has chosen to phase it down. In other cases, they have not. And in this case, the governor recommended keeping it at that level for 2
members,
years.
And I do believe in our what we have looked at, we do recommend that we phase it down. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, the next recommendation has to do with utility transition aid. This is not actually in the K-12 bill, but some of the tracking is including it there. And this has to do with a change made in the way that the Department of Revenue values utility property. This language, or essentially similar language, has already been included in the tax bill, which has been enacted. So there's some issues that need to be resolved in terms of the fiscal tracking for this, but we don't have language in front of this committee at this time dealing with that specific item. The K-12 reciprocity with neighboring states was initiated primarily with South Dakota, but the bill is written so that it would apply to reciprocity with any state. Essentially what this would do is it would make the same sort of financial arrangements between Minnesota and the neighboring state as we currently do for open enrollment within the state. Currently, we have a system where individual states along the border negotiate when students open enroll between bordering school districts, and that's created a lot of time-consuming negotiations for school districts. Often they're quite contentious. At times the commissioner's been brought involved to try to resolve some of the disputes. The state of North Dakota and South Dakota have a plan that they currently have in place that seems to be working quite well. The state of South Dakota did enact legislation this year authorizing this program. The Commissioner of Education has worked with the South Dakota Commissioner to try to make this a more workable system between the two states, where there would be a uniform tuition rate agreed upon between the states, if there was a net out-migration of students from Minnesota to South Dakota, currently have about 40 more students going to South Dakota than come into Minnesota, there would be a settle-up between the two states as opposed to having us pay the individual districts and then having the individual districts negotiate with the...
Dr. Melcher, I think that part of the bill might become more clear when we actually go through the language of the bill.
And there is, this would take effect in 2010, and there's a small tail that we're carrying, 56,000 in 2010 and 62,000 in 2011. We turn to the next slide. I'll deal with the reverse SOD aid payment shift, and Deputy Commissioner Anderson will deal with the MD operating budget reduction. The governor is recommending moving to a 90-10 payment schedule for school districts and SOD, which is consistent with the 90-10 payment schedule that we have for all other school districts. Historically, the state of Minnesota has funded all school districts on a 90-10 basis. The state had budget problems. A number of years ago, we went to an 80-20 payment schedule, and in order to avoid creating more serious problems for cash flow for SOD districts, there was a provision written into law which allowed them to get an extra 7% in advance, which moved them up to 87% rather than the 80% that other districts were at. When we paid off the tax shift, I don't think there was close consideration given to this issue, and I think we may have inadvertently funded these SOD districts at 97% during the year rather than the 90%. And this would return us to the longstanding practice of having all districts at 90% during their advance. There would be a one-time savings to the state of $6.1 million from doing that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, the governor is recommending a 4% reduction for the Minnesota Department of Education. That would result in a reduction of $860,000. This is consistent to his recommendation for every state agency in his budget.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Deputy Commissioner. Question, I'm looking at material and the focus on trying to address teacher quality and in retaining and recruiting good teachers or good prospective teachers. And I just am wondering, has the department looked at the whole issue of tenure and the current tenure structure and how that applies to this question? Is there any bearing on the kinds of tenure rules and regulations and how that might impinge on our ability to retain and recruit good, effective teachers?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, that's actually a good transition into the bill language because Article 1, Section 1 is recommended changes the governor has for teacher tenure. If we can just transition to that language, if that's all right, Madam Chair.
Commissioner, please.
Okay. In Section 1, in the governor's budget, he's recommending a change to the tenure process. Right now, currently, teachers are in probationary status for the first 3 years. They must have 3 annual reviews by an administrator or principal each year, and then that decision for tenure is made before or after year 3. After the teacher becomes tenured, it's up to the individual contract as to when and how often and what it looks like for the tenure review. What the governor is recommending with this language is that every tenured teacher would face an annual review, that the timing of that review annually and what the review would look like or how the teacher would be reviewed was up to must be negotiated by the local collective bargaining unit and the school board. But that's the changes he's recommending right now to the Teacher Tenure Act. He's not recommending eliminating tenure. He's just recommending one annual review each year.
Senator Saltzman.
That's just a question, Madam Chair. You know, I've always thought when we talked about teacher improvement and I know there's observations, but I've always thought when I have had reviews, when I had a different job, that the evaluation process always included something where you addressed what could I do better, and not to say that you're not doing a good job, but always how could I do better. And I think of a situation when I have my kids are 4 years apart, and in eighth grade they had the same teacher. And when my daughter came through 4 years later in a geography class, she had the exact same worksheet that my son had had. And I believe that one of the questions was, who is the dictator in Iraq? And it was Saddam Hussein was the answer, although he had been, I think that we all knew at the time that he was no longer the dictator of Iraq. But there was this sense of we're going to use worksheets and not. And so my letter to the principal was, what is this, you know, how are you working with your teachers every year to say, what can I do differently this year? That I'm not going to put the same thing in front of students I did the year before. So I guess this evaluation, I would be very open to having some language of a, and not, you know, to make this very difficult, but just some sort of improvement plan or just a statement of what could I do, what kind of staff development might I want to look for this year? I mean, just something that there's a conversation. So it's not just an evaluation of you are teaching well, but some sort of improvement plan for every teacher to think about. I think that that's what most businesses do with their employees. So,
Madam Chair, Commissioner Sussman, that's a really important part of, as you know, the QComp program, that they go through evaluations and observations, and they not only tell them what they need to improve, but what they're doing well, and then share those practices with other teachers and have time to do that. We tried not to be too, what we said in this program, if you are in the QComp program, what you do right now is sufficient for meeting this new requirement of annual reviews because they already have to have that. We tried not to be very prescriptive and as to what the review must say, leaving that up to the local collective bargaining unit and the school board to negotiate. But, you know, we're open to any language you might want to consider to strengthen that. And if you have suggestions, we'd be happy to consider that.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, and if you look at that first clause, that clause A, you're talking about the school board and the exclusive representative of the teachers. Wouldn't the isn't the role of the principal kind of center, kind of in the center of good management of what's going on in terms of the teachers? So you'd think that, I mean, I'm sure the school board would probably go to the principals, but I would think that you'd want to maybe we could spell out, if we're going to adopt something like this, that there be more involvement from the people who are most closely associated with the instructional activity of the of what's going on in the classroom. And, you know, man, it just seems to me that that's kind of the way the QComp was originally set up. I mean, it was not so much board-driven as it was school site driven. So I mean, if you're thinking about a good review, maybe we could design something that would be much more meaningful than just board and teacher. Because the minute you set that scenario up, you set up a kind of a adversarial relationship versus a kind of a working relationship.
Madam Chair, Senator Stumpf, I think that's a good suggestion. What we're trying to do is this is make this part of not separate this. This is kind of a collective bargaining issue in that we don't want something imposed onto teachers. We want them to work with their and school board is who they negotiate with. But, you know, even with the QComp program, where principals are very involved with the program and involved with the observations, the board and the exclusive representative teachers have to agree to submit an application to the state. We don't prescribe that the principal has to sign off too, but they are very involved. We would be open to language that would prescribe that, but we do also want to make sure that the teachers have some say as part of the collective bargaining process.
Thank you, Commissioner. With regard to your best instructional practices language, that's has not been defined. Do you have some language someplace else? What is your interpretation of that?
Madam Chair, that's somewhat similar to what is language in the QComp statute. Basically, a lot of them use rubrics like Charlotte Danielson. We try not to prescribe exactly what the instructional best practice may be, because over time we may discover there are better practices that we want teachers to employ. And if we have something written in statute, then they're stuck with a practice that may not have they've proved not to be effective, or maybe there's something that's more effective. So we're trying to strike a balance and not be too prescriptive. and allowing flexibility to for that to be negotiated.
Okay, let's move on.
Madam Chair and members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. Sections 2 through 11 of Article 1 deal with the proposal for tuition reciprocity between states. Sections 2 and 3 would be limiting the current tuition payment language to students that are not coming in under this proposed interstate tuition reciprocity agreement. Section 4 would be expanding the authority of the state to enter into interstate agreements beyond just South Dakota to any bordering state. At this time, we've only been working with South Dakota, but we thought there would be a possibility of future expansion to other states. Section 5 is clarifying language under the current provision where a student open enrolling out of Minnesota can, the parent can request that the commissioner agree on a rate. Actually, the commissioner sets the rate. The commissioner writes a memo to the district saying this is the rate you have to pay, and so we think it's more accurate to say set the rate rather than agree on a rate, and we have had to do that a number of times in the past few years where there have been disputes between the two districts. Section 6 is the the meat of the reciprocity language, and this would authorize the commissioner to enter into an agreement with the designated authority from the neighboring state. In this case, we're primarily looking at South Dakota. It would be with the Commissioner of Education in South Dakota, and this would set up the rules under which that agreement would need to be established. And the first of those would be on line 3.14, that the only students who were not from Minnesota that would be eligible would be students that reside in a district that borders the state of Minnesota. So it wouldn't be students from anywhere in South Dakota, just those who are right on the border with Minnesota. The rates that would be negotiated must be equal so that we're paying the same amount for a student that's going to South Dakota as they would pay us for a student that's coming into Minnesota. The way that this would work, if the adjoining state sent more students to Minnesota than Minnesota sent to South Dakota in this case, the state of South Dakota would pay the state of Minnesota the agreed-upon rate times the net difference in the number of students that were sent. Under Clause 4, if Minnesota sent more students, which is currently the case, the state of Minnesota would write a check to the state of South Dakota. So currently we have about a net outflow of about 40 students to the state of South Dakota. Under this provision, we would negotiate a rate. We're guessing it would be about $5,000 per student. So we would write a check to the state of South Dakota for 40 students times $5,000. It'd be about $200,000 to cover the cost of those students. The state of South Dakota would turn around then and count those students in their funding formula, and then they would pay their school district for those students as if they were South Dakota students. Also, the
Senator Stump.
Just Mr. Melcher, has the agreement been pretty well accepted on the part of both states up to this point?
Madam Chair and Senator Stump, yes, the Commissioner and I have had several meetings with Commissioner Melmer from the state of South Dakota. The state of South Dakota did pass comparable legislation this year, and this did require the same legislation to be enacted in both states. We've also had several meetings with the superintendents from the school districts along the border and with the Minnesota Rural Education Association. Mr. Warren from the Rural Education Association did testify in favor of the bill when this was heard in the House yesterday, and we believe that the superintendents along the border also have a consensus that they're supportive of this proposal.
Okay. Just Madam Chair, and this doesn't relate to the agreement, but how will the students be looked upon in terms of their tests and, you know, their grad, basically the Minnesota standards? For those students that are going to South Dakota, do they get their graduation certificate from South Dakota, or does that come back through their school district that they reside in?
Dr. Melton.
Madam Chair and Senator Stump, I'm not a testing expert, but my understanding is if the students are enrolled in the South Dakota High School, they're getting their diploma from the South Dakota High School. If the South Dakota kids come into Minnesota, they're getting their diploma from Pipestone High School or whatever the school district is, and they have to meet the same standards as any other student.
Okay. Thank you.
In addition to the items I've talked about, item 5 deals with what the application procedures would be. Item 6 is the reasons for which an enrollment options program might be denied. For example, if the school district was full, we have similar kinds of issues with open enrollment within Minnesota. Item 7 deals with transportation. It would clarify that the Minnesota district is not responsible for going into South Dakota to pick up any kids, but if they choose to do that, they can provide transportation service. Paragraph B deals with special education. We're presuming that there would be a higher rate that would be used for special education, and that would have to be negotiated between the two states.
Dr. Melcher, do we ever have students that go across the border to Canada or vice versa up on the northern borders?
Madam Chair, that's a good question. I think there may be some of that. Senator Stump, I think.
Senator probably. Stump.
Madam Chair, the answer is yes. The particular area that I know of is the Northwest Angle, and there we have Canadian students, primarily Indian students, that come from a reservation that's located very close to the Angle Inlet, which is the community in the Northwest Angle, and they're treated very similar, or pretty much the same as Minnesota students, in terms of the aid that the school district receives. And I believe all of the testing and everything, they're in a Minnesota school.
I do.
We do have reciprocity agreements with Manitoba, and I think, I'm not sure, but I think maybe Ontario for higher education. That hasn't been used very much, and it's unfortunate because as enrollment declines are being affected in the higher education communities, some of our campuses have room. Just north of the border, you have about 1.5 million population in and around the city of Winnipeg, where they could come down to, like, the University of Minnesota Crookston and Thief River Falls and East Grand Forks and Bemidji and those campuses, but it's never promoted to any large extent, which is unfortunate.
And Senator Stump, do you recommend that the department look into to having agreements with regard to K-12 as well in those instances?
Well, Madam Chair and Mr. Melcher, it may be of value in particular to communities like International Falls and the city of Bedette, because there they have children that do come across because of programs that one side or the other offer. And I don't know if, I don't know the exact agreements there between those communities, but there are some, over the years there's been a number of students that have flowed back and forth across the border there. So this agreement may work out as a good example to them too.
Madam Chair and Senator Stump, currently the language is only written for other states, but I'm sure that the department would be very happy to work with the Canadian governments as well to see if this, and with the superintendents in that area of the state, to see if this is something that they would like to see explored.
Thank you.
Yes. Turning to page 4 of the bill, subdivision 2 deals with pupil accounting. And what this essentially says is that South Dakota students that come into Minnesota under this plan would be counted as pupil units for the receiving school district, the same as a student that open enrolls from another district within the state of Minnesota. And that for Minnesota students who leave the state of Minnesota and go to South Dakota or another state, that they would be counted the same as a student who has left the Minnesota district. And what that means is that for referendum revenue, the resident district would still be able to count the student just as they do for open enrollment within the state, but for other pupil unit purposes, they would no longer be generating pupil units or funding for their home district within the state of Minnesota. Subdivision 3
Dr.
deals
Melcher,
with...
excuse me, I'm sorry. Does the referendum money pass over to the other state, the South Dakota? The state aid portion?
Madam Chair, I have to think through that one. I believe the way that we had structured this, that the intent was that the resident district would keep the local levy portion, but that the state aid portion would not be paid. It would be the same as if the student had open enrolled to another Minnesota school district. That was the goal. And I think what happens is the state would recapture those funds, and that might be part of what we use to pay the bill to the state of South Dakota for the 40 student net outflow.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Senator Rummel.
Just a quick curiosity question. Do we have any sense of how many students enroll in versus enroll out of the state?
Madam Chair and Senator Rummel, the latest data we have was that we have 120 students who are coming into Minnesota and about 165 that are going out to South Dakota currently. Now, in the future, we're going to have an increase, and we haven't factored this through all of the numbers yet, but just very recently, the Lake Benton School District in Minnesota has decided to close their high school, and they've worked out an arrangement with the Elkton School District about 4 miles away in South Dakota. So there will be about 58 additional students from Minnesota enrolling in South Dakota under that tuition arrangement as well. So we currently have about 40. This in the next year we'll move up to about 90. Turning back to page 4 of the bill, subdivision 3 deals with procedures. It is just specifying that the department will spell out what the procedures will be for the collection of data and so forth. Also that all of the students that are covered under open enrollment here will no longer be subject to any sort of tuition negotiations between the districts, that this is where this would be covered. There is an exception on line 421 to 425 that was added because of a provision that South Dakota added to their bill when they passed the bill. They made an exception for one school district. It's the Big Stone City School District, which currently enrolls about 110 students. And if they were included in this plan, they would fall below 100 students. And under South Dakota law, if you have fewer than 100 students, you're required to consolidate. And they didn't want to force that district to consolidate, so they wrote their law to say that they could be exempt and that they would continue to pay tuition to Ortonville, which is the Minnesota district on the other side of the border. So what we've done is added this paragraph D, which essentially says that for a district that has fewer than 150 pupils, they're exempted from participating in this, and they can continue the tuition arrangement. So we think that will work just fine. Section 7 is another exception provision, which says that basically if students are participating in an open enrollment program under this law, then the other existing tuition laws do not apply. Section 8 deals with special education, and it specifies that any net transfer of funds into or out of the state of Minnesota for special education would be adjusted from the special education aid appropriation. So in other words, if we have a net inflow of students coming in from South Dakota, we add that money into our special education appropriation and use that. We pay for our Minnesota teachers under special education, and so if we've got more South Dakota kids coming in, that probably means we might need more special education teachers. Yeah. Currently, we're funding those teachers through our state special education formula. This is just clarifying that if we're getting extra money from South Dakota to help cover that, that goes in and gets added on to our special education aid. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if we have a net outflow of kids, right now what's happening is we're appropriating the money in special ed. The districts use that to pay tuition to the South Dakota district. Instead, we would take money out of the special ed appropriation and pay the state of South Dakota to cover that rather than having it go into our aid and then have to pay it to South Dakota. So the bottom line is this ensures that there's no net cost to the state of Minnesota on the special education side of the aid picture. Section 9 deals with transition revenue. And what this essentially says is that if a Minnesota district is going to lose money under this in the first year of the plan, that we would calculate transition revenue for them so that they will be held harmless in terms of their revenue. And the reason for this provision, Madam Chair, is that the funding level is quite a bit higher in Minnesota than it is in South Dakota. Where we've had individual arrangements in the past, sometimes the rates are in the $2,000 difference, where we may be paying the district $7,000 and the state of South Dakota is only paying $5,000. So in the under the current situation, if a school district is losing kids to South Dakota, they may be getting $7,000 and then turning around and paying South Dakota $5,000, so making a net profit off of those kids. And what this would say is we're going to kind of lock that in so that those districts are held harmless based on what we're currently doing, rather than saying, well, we got you and you're going to lose that money. It's probably not the best policy to be paying them $7,000 and having them pay $5,000. But we felt like we didn't want to put those districts in a budget bind by saying we're going to take that away and recapture that money at the state level. This would require them to, if they want to continue that revenue, it would be an equalized levy under the transition program. So it does create some small levy impact under the bill. We think it's about $83,000 a year.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Melcher, and just to, I'm want to clarify this. I guess I was not aware till today that we had these cross-state boundary kind of open enrollment agreements, and I'm assuming, and you can correct me, but these are all things that families are deciding on their own, that they would rather move their child out of a Minnesota school to a South Dakota school or vice versa, and it's all just the result of individual decisions about programs, and is that essentially what this is accommodating?
Madam Chair and Senator Hahn, primarily that. There are also some cases where a school district has decided to form an agreement between districts where, for example, in the case of Lake Benton, they have now decided that they're going to discontinue their high school.
Okay.
And so they've reached a tuition agreement with the neighboring district in South Dakota. But it's primarily students who live along the border. In some cases, it's closer to the school in South Dakota than it is to the school in Minnesota.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Stelmstein.
I just feel the urge to share this little story with the committee. A number of years ago, one of the opponents that ran against me in an election, because when you have borders, it's always quite interesting. You know, he lived very close to North Dakota. He actually, his address was North Dakota, Drayton, North Dakota. And so on his first mailing that he sent out, he had, I won't give his name, but it was Mr. So-and-so, such and such address, Drayton, North Dakota, and it went out through all of the district. But he actually lived in a little tiny town called Robin, right alongside the border. And I'm sure somebody told him that you should get at least a Minnesota address if you're going to run for the legislature.
Thank you, Senator Stone.
Madam Chair, members, I'm going to move on next to the flood relief portion of the bill, which is Section 12. And this is amending the appropriation from the flood relief bill from last year from $584,000 to $268,000. The reduction here is due to the fact that the legislature last year appropriated money for flood relief both to the Department of Education and to the Department of Public Safety. So there was an
Members,
error in the bill,
this
which
is the amendment that
funding.
We moved at the very beginning.
Yes.
The A2 amendment. Go ahead, Dr. Melcher.
And so what this language would do is to reduce appropriations where the amount of money appropriated was too large, in an amount sufficient to offset the additional dollars that would be paid to the Rushford-Peterson School District to continue with the two additional years of enrollment decline and extra transportation funding.
Dr. Melcher, on lines 7.11 through 7.18, you're reinstating all that language and you're putting the $120,000. So will that money all be spent?
Madam Chair, we do not anticipate that money will be spent. There are enough dollars in the public safety appropriation to fully cover the cost of the flood relief for the for the districts that were affected. So I think what the Department of Finance has opted to do, and they may wish to speak to this, is to simply pull out enough dollars from the existing appropriations to cover the $316,000 cost of the payments that would be going to the Rushford-Peterson School District. And so we're not doing kind of a global update on the forecast here. We're just doing an update sufficient to cover the cost of the Rushford-Peterson.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, the section 15 is dealing with the appropriations for Rushford-Peterson, and this again is part of the amendment that is appropriating $316,000 to the Rushford-Peterson School District. This is based on $7,152 times the 16.5 students that they have lost. We anticipate that we would actually spend $158,000 in fiscal 2009, and that $158,000 would be carried forward to fiscal year 2010, and that would then be used to pay for the fiscal year 2010, the third year of the flood relief to the Rushford-Peterson School District.
Dr. Melcher, is that customary to carry forward this kind of money into a next biennium?
Madam Chair, not to my knowledge. This is something that was requested by the Department of Finance in order to, I think, set aside these dollars for this purpose.
Is the Department of Finance somebody from the department here to address that issue? Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, my name is Britta Rayton with the Department of Finance. The language is not typical, but it is the only way we could ensure that the dollars would be there for Rushford-Peterson in 2010, since we can't actually appropriate in 2010.
Couldn't we just appropriate it next time in the next legislative session when we determine exactly what the money would be needed at that time?
That's a decision that the legislature could make, and this is just the governor wanted to ensure that the dollars were there for Rushford-Peterson in 2010, and this was the language that would allow that to happen.
Madam Chair, Deputy
Commissioner,
I'll just add one piece that just kind of on the timing of school district funding and budgeting. They have to set their budgets of April of every year because they have to continue their teacher contracts. And so I think the idea was is that if we left this open to the 2009 session, that the legislature doesn't end till the end of May, the district has to make a decision about the budget, and would it be sort of in limbo. And so that's kind of always it is about the increases on the formula, but at least in this case for Rushford-Peterson, that experienced some decline in enrollments, and they're trying to move back, that we could guarantee that they would at least have this as part of the budget.
Commissioner and members, I just want to point out that that is true for every school district in the state, and so it is setting precedent. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, the last section in Article 1, Section 16, is the repealer of the advanced final payment for the statutory operating district, so that all districts in the state would be funded on a 90-10 basis. And that is a $6.1 million one-time savings to the state.
Madam Chair, moving to Article 2, Section 1, this is the Minnesota Virtual Education Program I discussed previously. I will add a couple things. One is this is for grades 6 through 12, so it's not for every grade. The program, going to page 9, would be required to establish at least 10 student courses and teacher lesson plans by the 2009-2010 school year. The state online courses is not meant to be comprehensive and a lot of courses, but it's meant to cover core courses that all districts can access. That if a district wants to participate or a charter school wants to participate, they must submit a letter of intent to the Commissioner of Education. They must then agree to allow their students to participate in the program. They must train their teachers to monitor and deliver the courses. They must allow their students to receive graduation credit, if appropriate, for successful completion of the program. The district's responsible for issuing the grades to the students enrolled in the online courses, and then they must report the progress to the department. This is sort of to establish some equal playing ground In the online learning field, one of the things that we found from a lot of superintendents, particularly in rural Minnesota, is that they had a very high interest in developing online courses, but the cost was prohibitive, and also it seemed inefficient to have a lot of different school districts developing the same online courses. So if the district decides to participate in this, they agree to be a partner in this and help in the development of that to ensure the courses are aligned to state standards.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. I'm curious to note that you're dealing with core courses. Can you give us examples of, like, school districts and the courses that they're not able to offer that this would give them relief for? Because I think this is probably a very good idea.
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, an example, we have huge shortages in science areas because there's a lot of specialized science courses. We hear a lot that physics is not offered a lot in rural Minnesota because maybe they only have two or three sections of students interested in taking physics, and they can't hire a full-time teacher or they can't find a teacher to do that. And so this would allow them to access an online course for that. So there's a lot of examples I know in science. One of the priority that's given to the commissioner in the development of the courses is in science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and advanced courses. So there might be some really good engineering courses. For example, the science standards are looking at an engineering strand. That's probably not something that that they could develop offhand in the school district. So one of the priorities is to have some sort of engineering course that they could access. It's really just trying to provide more of an equal playing ground for all school districts. Madam Chair, Section 2 is the Minnesota Teach Program that we discussed. I will note in under B, I was just Karen Ballmer from the Board of Teaching mentioned to me that we should strike Praxis 2 because they do have to issue an RFP. It's actually a vendor. We get so used to using names sometimes, like the copy machine is a Xerox machine, but it's really a copy machine. But so she just requested that we strike that because it is a vendor. But going on to page 10, we talked about the requirements.
Commissioner.
Sure.
So I assume you were talking past the Praxis 2 subject assessment. Is that what you're referring to? You're just removing?
Yes, and what we should say, pass a subject assessment for each subject area taught. So Praxis 2 is a vendor. So
thank you.
Okay. Going to page 9, what I'd like to talk about that we didn't go over in the PowerPoint is subdivision 2. We talked about what's the initial entrance for teachers in the PowerPoint, but once a teacher is accepted into the program, the program includes, they have to have a pre-induction preparation program that includes classroom management techniques and on-site classroom observation that is completed before the candidate is employed in the classroom. Two, they must complete a rigorous training that includes instruction and standards of effective practice and essential skills that include curriculum, instructional strategies, and classroom management. This can happen after school and on Saturdays throughout the year. That leads to a teaching license and up to 15 graduate credits towards a master's degree in education. Three, the district has to provide on-the-job mentoring, supervision, and evaluation. And of course, it's arranged by the employing district. Four, they have to have three evaluations by an evaluation team composed of the mentor, the supervisor, the principal, and a training program member. That includes at least three classroom observations consistent to the evaluations. Five is a one-week intensive workshop that includes analysis and reflection of the first year of teaching after completing the school year. The program approval, this must be done in partnership with the higher education institution. So what would happen is a higher education institution would agree to be the post-secondary institution that submits the program to the Board of Teaching. The Board of Teaching then would approve or disapprove that program. In the first year, that teacher would be issued a temporary license. If the teacher is successful and meets the criteria, then they would be issued a full license plus 15 graduate credits through that institution.
Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, one of the things that I noticed since we had kind of looked at this before, we currently have in Chapter 136 a teacher education and compensation program called TEACH, and I was just wondering how, if you were, could point out the differences between the program here and the one that we currently have in statute. It seems like it might have been built on that or uses some of the foundations for it.
Madam Chair, Senator Stumpf, I think you might be referring to the Q program, the Urban Educator Program that was established to help bring in teachers into the St. Paul and Minneapolis school districts.
Well, Madam Chair and Commissioner, that program I'm familiar with, this one is more, it seems like it's more associated with the early childhood and explanation is the Teacher Education and Compensation Helps Program, called TEACH, is established to provide tuition scholarships and education incentives to early care and education providers.
Ms. Weber?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Stumpf, my name is Michelle Weber. I'm the Director of Government Relations at the Department of Education. That is a program for child care providers to access higher education opportunities that you're referring to.
Madam Chair, what you're doing here is kind of extending it to all of our basic, not that program, but designing a program called TEACH for alternatives for teachers, basically.
Madam Chair, Senator Stumpf, they happen to have the same name. The TEACH program for child care providers is to provide professional development opportunities for them through by accessing higher education programs. It's not an incentive to recruit them into the teaching field.
Commissioner and Senator Stumpf's comments might make you want to reconsider the name for that. I don't know that you'd want to have two programs in statute with the same name.
Madam Chair, the TEACH name is a nationally trademarked name with the child care programs. They call it TEACH and Retain, I believe.
Yeah, Commissioner, I was referring to the program that you're doing today. You might want to consider that.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Senator Rummel.
I think we're still on the alternative licensure. When someone receives this licensure, do they enter the classroom at the base level of teacher salary, or do they enter it at a mid-career level? I'm just trying to get whether or not there is enough incentive for people to switch over.
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, it's up to the employing district to make that offer. Obviously they would have they could come into the profession with a master's degree and be placed higher on the salary schedule. Depending on the contract and the salary schedule a district has, they can place teachers at different levels. They don't necessarily need to place them at step one. So it would be up to the district making the employment offer.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Section 3 is the UTEACH program. This is the program providing up to six education courses for free for selected majors, students who are majoring in math and science as an undergraduate. Section 4 is the Tier 1 of the Teacher Institute. We talked about Tier 2 being the math and science academies. We're requesting additional funding. Tier 1 is the training of 500 math and science teachers each year through a summer institute. Madam Chair, Section 5 is the appropriation section. Subdivision 2 is the $1 million for the development of the Minnesota Virtual Education Program. Subdivision 3 is the Minnesota TEACH Program, requesting $250,009 for the startup of the program. And then,
excuse me, Commissioner, Senator Clark.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, we've been fine, Madam Chair. If Ms. Anderson had gotten through this, but here's my question. I was just a little bit curious, and I really appreciate the time you're taking today, but as it relates to the appropriations, you know, the governor's proposing a 4% cut to the agency, and you've got a couple of different places on here that you're putting admin in, And it looks like, at least as it relates to the TEACH one, it's about 16.7% admin, and on the math and science teacher centers and institutes, and again, this is not about the core of the program, just about admin, just asking. That looks like it's about 10.2% admin, and I guess, you know, kind of a couple different things. It seems like usually we do admin entirely separately, and the overall agency budget into the AIDS budget is about 0.3%. So I'm just both curious about how this relates to the governor's proposed cuts to you. Does this mitigate it somewhat? Is it usual to go ahead and stick the admin with it here? I mean, just kind of what's your thinking and how does this actually play out as we're moving forward with this not fun situation?
Madam Chair, Senator Clark, it's sort of hit and miss whether or not admin money is put into different programs that are developed. We've seen it both ways. Like, for instance, the after-school grant program that the legislature funded in 2007 did provide the department with administrative money. That's just one recent example. If you look at, just for example, the places where we are asking for additional funding, for instance, the Minnesota TEACH program, there's administrative costs with bringing districts together, having someone run the program. A lot of the money will be used to help support bringing the teachers into the classroom, but we have to have some way to administer the program, and that's why it's being requested. If you look at the total dollars amounts spent for Minnesota TEACH when the district decides to participate, they're spending money too because their benefit is they're getting a supply of teacher candidates to go into their classroom, but they also need to pay those teachers a salary. So there's a cost to that too. But they have a vacancy, so there's kind of a trade-off in that. If you look at the math and science teacher centers and institutes, we have partnered with higher education. That money is actually for the Department of Education and for us to flow money to the higher education institutions that agree to partner with us for space rental, for use of their faculty. And if you look at their time and effort that they're spending on this, they're spending far more of their in-kind dollars than we're providing in administrative dollars. We try to be very judicious in providing administrative dollars, but recognize we also sometimes need that in order for the programs to be successful. This will not supplement the 4% reduction that we're facing because we currently do not undertake these activities. That 4% reduction was applied to all state agencies, as you know, across the board. We will need to, upon enactment of any reduction, whether it be 4% or another figure, we will need to evaluate where we're at on staffing. Right now we're under a hiring freeze, and I think to anticipate the budget cuts and where we're going to be, and those decisions will have to be made once we receive our reduction, and then we'll have to look at where we need to, where how much we'll need to reduce. And, of course, we'll have to go through procedures with our state unions and meet and confer with them and go through that process. So it's not, as I said before, the administrative dollars associated with the programs is not meant to sort of cushion the blow, I guess, so to speak, on the reduction to the $860,000 reduction. That will have to be dealt with separately.
Senator Clark.
Madam Chair, it does seem, though, like, and even saying this is a bad thing, that it ultimately it might, because I would think that you'd be moving people around because of the hiring freeze. So people who otherwise might ultimately be laid off under that situation may end up doing these programs. So that's just a comment. And just, again, just trying to get my head around where we're going as we're moving forward. And then I guess the other question is, even if a district believes that the TEACH program could be a very good one, given what we've been hearing from districts about where they're at financially, this then doesn't include any financial incentives for the districts to participate at this point, does it? I mean, how do you perceive that working out?
Madam Chair, Senator Clark, the districts participating in it would have to show a shortage area, and despite some of the bleak fiscal news, districts do still have shortage areas. Special ed is a very acute shortage area. We hear that a lot. They can't find enough candidates to fill special education positions. In rural areas, the math and science areas is still a shortage area where they can't find enough math and science teachers. So the districts that participate in this, they would be coming in with vacancies in those targeted shortage areas, and they would be filling those jobs because they would need to have those teachers in their schools.
Okay. Senator Clark.
And just one last thing, and I apologize if this sounds tongue-in-cheek, but yesterday in Senator Wieger's committee, one of the things on a bipartisan basis we were bringing forward was the notion of an Office of Early Learning. And our thought was that there'd be next to no additional budget cost, maybe a director, but otherwise we'd use it, existing folks. And I was a little surprised to find out in my paper that the governor is opposing that. I'm not sure if that's the case, but my question, I guess, here would be my tongue-in-cheek, is that Brian McClug said that this is just another example of out-of-control tax and spend Democrats at work. So I guess a question I would have is that a bipartisan way of saying that the governor's proposals here that are going to cost money, could that be perceived the same way? And it's tongue-in-cheek. I hope we can keep the rhetoric down as we're moving forward. You have a number of good proposals moving forward, and we're all going to have some really hard work to do as we're trying to figure out with a limited resource situation. And so you don't really have to comment on the Office of Early Learning because I know it'll come here eventually, but I hope that we all take both your proposals moving forward that will have some fiscal implication, and maybe other members that may be Republicans or Democrats in a similar light. So that's just kind of hopefully we can just keep the rhetoric down. Thanks.
And Commissioner and Senator Clark, to those points, I have now understood that after making these adjustments and looking at the money that's going back in versus the amount that was taken out of the MDE, the net reduction would be approximately 1.7% if you looked at it from the same buckets of money. So thank you.
Thanks.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, thank you for that point. I will say on the Minnesota Teach program and the math science centers, it's not necessarily the money is going to be spent at the Department for Administration. It could actually be flowed to the higher education institutions to run those programs or to partner with us. So it just depends on the partnership we create, and we want higher ed to be our partner in these programs. Going on to subdivision 4 is the UTeach program. That's $250,000. Actually, that would directly flow to the higher education institutions that agree to participate in the program. Subdivision 5 is the $400,000 for the Principals Leadership Institute. Right now, actually, the university is housed at the University of Minnesota. They run the NISL. It's called the NISL program, and that money flows to them in a grant contract. Subdivision 6 is additional funding for the math and science teacher centers and institutes, or otherwise known as academies. You'll see that it's requesting additional dollars of $2.7 million. Madam Chair, going to Article 3, this is the reduction for the agency. It's $860,000. In addition, all executive branch agencies took a 4% reduction, so you'll see a reduction on line 22 for the Board of Teaching, and you'll see a reduction on line 24 for the Board of School Administrators. With that, I believe that completes the bill, Madam Chair.
Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to go back to Article 2 on the virtual education program. The top of page 9. The goal would be to set out and have available, if I understand this correctly, programs. We don't spell out how many, but that some programs, online programs, would be available for the 2009-2010 school year. I guess my question would be, do we have any program? Well, is that a realistic date, or do we currently have some programs that can move into that realm very quickly? And if so, like what programs might be out there right now that we could kind of gather them and get them fine-tuned so that they meet the need?
Sure, Madam Chair, Senator Stumpf. The language I have here is directing at least 10 student courses and teacher lessons by the 09-10 school year. There's we didn't presuppose a path because it could be a potential where we're contracting with a vendor, and so we'd have to go through a request for proposal process. But there's a couple ways you can do this. You could put out an RFP process requesting, do you have these courses available, whatever is decided. And then purchase that product and then bring in Minnesota educators to review it actually before you purchase it, but bringing Minnesota educators to review it and adapt it to make sure it aligns to Minnesota state standards. The second process you could use is developing developing the online tool is not difficult. It's already out there. You can even go to open source and get something like that. But then developing what's existing right now, not existing right now, meaning it could be, what's taught, what should be taught in a chemistry course. Let's just say chemistry is what we want to use. And you bring in a syllabus and you bring in the standards and you develop it basically from what it is, and then you load it into an online system. So there's a couple different ways that you could do it. What we didn't want to do is prescribe or write in a vendor or a provider, because what we want is a competitive process. So that they demonstrate to us that they meet the requirements, and then we bring in Minnesota educators to verify that and or adapt it and align it to the Minnesota standards.
Okay. Madam Chair, one other point is that when you look at the science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and advanced courses, are there other areas that school districts would see this as being helpful?
Madam Chair, this wasn't meant to say only these courses, but to give it a priority. When we looked at our shortage areas, particularly in math and science, that's why that was that focus. Also, there's a lot of interest when we solicited advice that they'd like to offer more advanced courses, but they don't have enough sections to have a teacher teach it. And so, they may in a small rural school have a dozen kids in a grade interested in advanced courses, but it's just not a large enough classroom to be able to do that, something like that. Where an online learning then gives them that opportunity, because the students can go in a computer lab, they can take the course, they can have a teacher monitoring it, they can do the assessments, but they can use their existing staff to do some of that. So that's why we just said priority. Doesn't mean that's the only courses, but that's sort of where that comes from.
Thank you. And I believe there's a testifier as well. Is there anybody else in the audience who wanted to speak on behalf or opposed to this bill? Yes, Peter, go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Peter Lindstrom. I'm from the Minnesota High Tech Association. Just wanted to spend a minute and give a business perspective on the science and technology, mathematics, portions of this legislation. And first, MHTA is a nonprofit trade association with about 350 high-tech company members in Minnesota. We are strong supporters of the Minnesota Teach provision, the alternative teacher licensure. We recognize that today's careers are no longer linear in fashion or traditional. In fact, I just heard a statistic that says that by the age of 40, today's learners will have gone through an average of 14 different careers. So it's important that you know that today's professionals are mobile and open to different career choices. Now, we, of course, acknowledge that just because you're an engineer or a network administrator doesn't automatically make you an excellent teacher, and that's why we think it's important to recognize the rigorous program, the one-year training component of this legislation. And also, it's important for you to know that business representatives will be part of the process of creating this alternative teacher licensing program, which we support. The members of MHTA are also very supportive of increasing the skills of today's math and science teachers. Of course, good students can become great with the help of teachers who excel in their area of expertise, and it makes especially a lot of sense in the math and sciences, where the world is constantly changing. The Math and Science Teacher Academies will give teachers specialized knowledge and enhanced skills that will improve their student performance. On the virtual education program, we're also strong supporters of that aspect of this legislation. I want to quote the governor from his State of the State address. He described it as a world-class, digitally stored, always available, anywhere, anytime, jaw-dropping, eye-popping teaching toolbox accessible to all our teachers and students. What a fantastic a tool for teachers to access top shelf curriculum and for students. In fact, I wanted to let you know that MHTA, in partnership with the Department of Education, is developing our own jaw-dropping, eye-popping web portal called Get STEM. And it's just in beta phase right now. Will be coming out in the next couple of months. But it's going to be a web portal where it's a just-ask, just-offer concept. So school districts can just ask, meaning they can ask for mentors, they can ask for classroom presenters, they can ask for computers, they can ask for microscopes. And then businesses, science, technology businesses, can just offer on this same portal. So they can say, hey, I'm from 3M, I'm from Thompson West. We want to come into your classroom and talk about what are the eye-popping, jaw-dropping things that we're doing. And by the way, we have 50 microscopes that we have, or 100 computers that we're upgrading, and we want to offer to you. So again, that's Get STEM, and that'll be up and live here in the next couple of months. So why is all this important? This is important because today's students will be tomorrow's engineers, tomorrow's scientists, tomorrow's network administrators. And these jobs, these science and technology jobs, pay 67% more than the average private sector job, 67% more. And there's 127,000 of these jobs right here in Minnesota. Just to wrap up, I would say that of course, math and science is important if you're going into these careers, but it's also important just for a more broader perspective. It's critical if we don't expect everyone to become a mathematician, but we should expect, for example, that folks should recognize that a 3% unemployment rate is much better than a 6% unemployment rate, and they should be able to have a pretty basic understanding of crunching numbers, working in teams, and those types of things that STEM brings to us. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks. Thank you.
Mr. Lindstrom, thank you for being here. And I have had the occasion to work with the Minnesota High Tech Association when I came before this association and asked for the association to consider contributing to our electronic whiteboards in our state. And so I continue to bring that up as something that we would welcome. And we do appreciate your collaboration and your partnership and think that that is a way that the business community can make a difference here today in educating our children.
Thank you.
Anyone else want to testify or comment on the bill? Commissioner Anderson, thank you for presenting it today. And oh, good. We do have more. Very good.
Madam Chair, members, I'll try to be brief. Sam Walseth with the Minnesota Rural Education Association. I want to just offer a couple of comments. First is to thank the department for the border state tuition reciprocity language they've got in the bill. That is something MREA has worked on for a number of years. And we think we finally got things worked out. And so that is important language to my association, and we hope that moves forward this session. And then secondly, a lot has been mentioned about opportunities in rural Minnesota for science and math, and we do struggle in greater Minnesota to hire those science and math teachers. As Mr. Lindstrom just mentioned, those jobs pay 67% more, and when our small rural districts are offering $28,000 for starting jobs for recent physics grads, it's pretty hard to compete with 3M when they're going out there and offering $60,000 for those starting jobs. So we think the Math and Science Academy language and appropriation that's in here, too, is going to go a long way to help us sustain those programs in greater Minnesota. So I just want to offer some thanks to the department and the committee for considering those proposals.
Thank you.
Renee Laura with Education Minnesota. We have not looked very closely at all the provisions that the governor's proposal refers to in the actual bill proposal here. However, we have heard the concept language or the concepts behind this proposal, and felt that we ought to let you know that we have not heard anything that we would dismiss offhand. The teacher contract, the teacher tenure post or tenure review idea, for example, is something that school districts, some of them follow. Statute requires it of probationary teachers, and so this would extend it to tenured. We do have, you know, we think that it is a lot of work to do it annually, and so, for example, we would propose that it be more of a periodic requirement just for logistical, practical purposes for it to work. And so we'll look at the language, but in concept, it is not something that we would dismiss offhand.
And if you do not support a annual, do you have a time frame in mind?
That would be something. I think the first thing that came to mind is a periodic language, but it could be something else. And it is just, if you want to do it right, it would require a lot of work. As it stands now, the concept, obviously, if it is expanded to include other things that just aren't doable, that story would change. We would like to point out, though, that in all of these proposals and others floating around, the Achilles heel is the funding. We can have great ideas, but if they are not supported by funding, the great idea becomes sometimes even worse than status quo. We would fear that that would be the case in this situation. Last week we learned that teachers lost their tuition or their tax credit, tax deduction for classroom supplies in the bill that was sent to the governor and passed by the legislature. That is something that, for example, would be, you know, if we're looking for new funding for new programs, and at the same time we're losing the income tax deduction for the state income tax for teacher classroom supplies, it kind of does not make sense. And so just from that perspective, we are looking at a situation where funding kind of makes a difference between great idea, great implementation, something that is counterproductive. So that is all we have to say at this point, but we will look carefully through the bill and provide you very detailed feedback as to how it might be improved, how it might be made workable, and we'll see what we can move forward with at that point.
Thank you, Mr. Lara. Senator Stump.
There was, Madam Chair, there was a question that crossed my mind in relationship to the Principals Leadership Institute. And I'm just wondering if in some of these areas, if we could get a little bit more of a filled out budget sheet to see whether these dollar figures are firm or not. I think in some cases there was some suggestion that maybe some of it might even be, and in that one particular, possibility of even getting some matching money from some places. And I don't know if there's somebody here that might comment on that or.
Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair, Senator Stump, we can provide you some additional information. Also, I don't know if there's a plan to request a fiscal note, but that would then provide you with information on all the initiatives.
Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chairman, I think we've done a pretty good job filling up the fiscal note requests over at the department. I didn't do one on this one because it was a simple appropriation, but if members would like to see some more detail on it, we can certainly give the department one more fiscal note to do. It's at your pleasure.
Good. Anybody else wish to comment on the bill?
Madam Chair, my name is Kirk Schneidlin, representing the Minnesota School Boards Association. And we, too, have some concerns about the first section about the annual review. And one of the issues that comes to light is the issue of the fact that while we may be in an agreement here between the school board and the representatives, what happens in those instances if there isn't an agreement reached on the evaluation process? We also, when you look at all of the continuing contract, and Mr. Lara touched on that as well, is that in from our perspective, may be something that may be negotiated or talked about in terms of a periodic or a cyclical review process, because we know that our building principals do a great job of evaluation, but the challenge is to do all of our teachers could be very burdensome, and so we would like to see some language loosened up there. And then thirdly, the piece on the Q-Comp is that districts are receiving revenue to do these evaluations through the Q-Comp process. But that's only to those districts who have received Q-Comp revenue. This would apply to all school districts, not necessarily, not just the Q-Comp districts. And so there would be revenue for those districts to use it for evaluation where some of those other districts wouldn't receive that. So I just want to make some of those comments and be on the record for that.
Thank you. Go ahead, and we have another testifier. We want to try and wrap this up. The session has begun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Joanne Knuth, Executive Director of the Minnesota Principals Association, and I will make my comments very brief. I want to add to the two previous gentlemen in terms of annual review of teachers. First of all, let me say it is extraordinarily important as an instructional leader in a building that a principal knows what's going on in every classroom. And a good instructional leader will be in those classrooms daily, not necessarily in a formal evaluative process, but in an understanding of the instruction being delivered, the instructional practice, the curriculum, and so on. So that should be standard practice in every building. That being said, I concur with the two previous gentlemen that if we were to include language of periodic review, we then could give some local control and expectation to carry out that review to the superintendent and principal. So I would encourage consideration of that language. My second comment is regarding the Principal's Academy. The expectation that a principal as an instructional leader is in the classroom is very much determined by the principal's knowledge of what instructional leadership really means. I am so grateful to the legislature for their support and commitment to the development of real instructional leadership among our principals. So I want to express my gratitude on behalf of the Secondary Principals Association, and may I also add the Elementary Principals Association for your continued support of Principals Academy.
Well, Ms. Kenneth, we know how important that you principals are to our students, so thank you.
Thank you.
I believe this concludes the comments. We will be meeting next Tuesday and Wednesday, and the bills that will be discussed are still up in the air as we're trying to complete the education policy, and so we will have those agendas forthcoming. Unless Senator Stumpf has any further things to add? With regard to this, is there a motion to put this bill on the table? Senator Stumpf moved that we put Senate File 3631 on the table for possible inclusion in the Education Omnibus Bill. As amended. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is passed. Committee is adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. That's a big one. Ethiopia.